government will now come to order, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2890, and we'll have our committee administrator fill us in on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill comes to you at the request of Associated General Contractors. It would require written notice of a right to file bond claim on public contracts. There should be a dash one amendment at your place or in your file, one of the two places. And I believe AGC is here to talk about their bill.
All right, we'll call up Cindy Cato, Larry Sitz, and David Anderson, please. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Wilhelm. Committee. For the record, my name is Cindy Cato. I represent Associated General Contractors. I know you've heard it before, but AGC is 1,200 members of companies who are actively involved in the commercial construction industry in the state of Oregon. We have general contractors, specialty contractors, equipment suppliers, the whole gamut of people who participate in the industry throughout Oregon and Southwest Washington. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come today and express our support for House Bill 2890. I'm going to start off with a few general comments, and then I'm going to turn the microphone over to the two experts that I brought with me today so that you can get some real-life examples of why we think 2890 is a good improvement to public contracting for the state. What happens now on complex public contracts, projects, is that our general contractors don't always have full knowledge of all of the parties who are providing work and service on the project. And that is because the subcontractors to which they have a direct contractual relationship turn around and have contractual relationships with others who supply goods and services and labor and all of those types of things. And so when we say we want to, that we stand for prompt payment and that we are 100% in favor of prompt payment down the full line of all of the people who are involved in construction projects, we have an impediment because we don't always know who's involved in the construction project down the line. So what we've hoped to do with 2890 is provide a tool that will assure prompt payment to all of the companies who are providing goods and services on a construction project, and also avoid a problem that we've found occurs, which is double payment. And that happens when, unbeknownst to the general contractor who has made faithful payment to the subcontractor, that subcontractor in turn does not make prompt and faithful payment to the folks that they've contracted with. We have no way of knowing that. However, by having the notice that is filed, that is required for 2890, what will happen is everyone who is not a direct contractor with our generals will have to give notice of the right to provide a claim against the bond that the general contractor has to post on a public project. By doing this, the general contractor can assure that everyone down the stream gets payment. That's in our general contractor's best interest. That's in the second and third tier contractors and suppliers' best interest. And that's what we want to be responsible. We think it's in the best interest of the public agencies also, and will alleviate a lot of problems with misunderstandings and between the various parties on the project. We also believe that by getting this notice of the ability to claim, that we then, as general contractors, won't have to pay twice for anything, which is what happens now. And so we think we're solving two problems, and we think we're solving them very simply. First of all, we'll know everyone on the job site and know that they will be paid, and they will be paid promptly for the work that they've provided. And secondly, this would alleviate the general contractor ever having to make double payments, which has occurred. And I'll leave the details of how that works in the real life to to the two general contractor members that I've brought with me, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any? Thank you.
Just for the record, I'm Dave Anderson. I'm president of Anderson Construction Company of Portland, Oregon. We are a general contractor that does building, industrial construction, a lot of institutional work. I thank you very much for this opportunity to come before you today, Chair Wilson, committee members. Public work means a lot to us. In fact, last year it represented about 28% of our volume. And so we want to make sure that it works well for the public, our customers. One of the core values that Anderson has adopted for our company is long-term relationships with not only our clients, but with our vendors, subcontractors, and such. And we're kind of finding what 2890 will do for us will sustain that long-term relationship. We found a key to long-term relationships, particularly with subcontractor suppliers, is that they get paid for the work that they've done in a prompt manner. And unfortunately, over the years, because the statutes don't currently support us knowing who everybody is on the job site, we have some trouble doing that. For example, over the last 4 years, we've had, until just recently, we've had three such issues where we've had to pay more than once for the same amount of work that was performed, which gets a little bit more than frustrating. Just recently, on a publicly funded project, we had a subcontractor to a subcontractor that we really didn't know even existed because they were a labor broker for our subcontractor, so we weren't aware that our subcontractor was essentially buying their labor force. The subcontractor completed his work for which he was paid, and then we get a file or a lien, essentially a file on our bond for what works out to be about 11% of the contract value of our subcontractor. So now we're faced with an issue where we got 11% of this contract. We have to maybe pay again. So this kind of is near and dear to our hearts. In fact, over these, now there's four issues that have happened over these last 4 years, including the current one I just mentioned. It amounts to about $215,000 worth of work that we've had to pay for twice. That's out of a contract value to these subcontractors about $1.45 million. So we're getting burned by this. Now, obviously, we've been in the business, this will be our 49th year, so to survive as long as we have, we've developed some protection mechanisms, which some work better than others. The first one we've developed is that we've added more management horsepower to the project so that we can track who's on the job sites. Now, unfortunately, what this does is it raises the cost of the project. So the publics are essentially getting a little less project for the dollar because we have more horsepower in terms of dollars being committed to manpower to go and watch this. So we don't end up paying twice for some of these things. The second approach that we've taken to kind of control our double payment problem is we've withheld payment as long as we possibly can within the law to make sure that we get all these people flushed out. We find, once again, this flies in the face of our desire to, our core value, to pay promptly and develop these long-term relationships. But to protect ourselves, we kind of take it as far as we can. And what happens typically is people start getting anxious for their money, and that flushes some people out into the open that we might otherwise not know about. Neither of those works very well, but there is an option that would work very well, and that's what House Bill 2890 represents. Essentially, it would require that everybody come forward and file the right to lien on a bond or file a claim on the bond. That way, we'd know who everyone was, and we could make sure that everybody's getting paid on the job. We could back off some of the labor force that we're throwing extra managerial onto.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would the subcontractor know who the third-tier subcontractor was if they were not, in fact, involved in obtaining that third-tier subcontractor?
So a subcontractor to the subcontractor.
Right.
Well, that's a good question. I think they, too, have a problem.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
You know, I've been thinking about this since this bill was brought to my attention yesterday, and wouldn't it be easier to just require on your contracts that anybody that they're going to sub with, they notify you who they are going to subcontract with for those services? Wouldn't that just clarify everything right up front? So if you did it on your initial contract, then you would know who they're going to sub with, and if they decided to sub to somebody else, then they would be required based on the contract to notify you.
Well, I think the family tree gets so long and sometimes cumbersome that you don't get everybody. And like we said, we're not having problems typically with our subs.
Mm-hmm.
We're having troubles with our subs sometimes, or suppliers and such like that we have no idea even exist out there.
If I could follow up again, Mr. Chair, but if in your initial contract with your sub, you stated in that contract that you would not be responsible for any payment to anyone who has not been brought to your attention prior to the completion of the work, then I don't see how you could be held liable if, in fact, your contract that they signed clearly says that they're responsible for providing you that information.
Well, there's a question here of, you know, how administratively you get all that done at every level. Because it steps down and you get
this away. Sounds like a really cumbersome process. Yeah.
Let me add something here. This situation
you
only happened. Excuse me. I'm Larry Sitz, Vice President of Emmerich Construction, General Building Contractor based in Portland. David's competition, although he's bigger than we are and more sophisticated, but we do work in his arena. This really only comes to play when the subcontractor we're talking about is going broke. And when they're in that situation, one, they tend to lie because they're struggling to stay alive. And two, once they don't exist, whatever our contract said between us and them no longer matters. And so what we're dealing with is they don't exist, and we're dealing with the law that is on this bond claim, and we're dealing with their suppliers. And they have rights that that subcontract can't touch. And so they can get to us no matter what our subcontract says. And they do.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thanks. Sorry.
So just kind of piggyback on what Larry just told you, essentially we've got a cumbersome process that gets more and more difficult as people come and go on jobs. And frequently exactly that happens where you have a subcontractor that fails. And when they fail, unfortunately, they don't always tell us that they're failing. And there's a funny relationship that occurs between a subcontractor and their suppliers and their subcontractors. You can call them direct, which I said we have been doing now. We've been adding the managerial horsepower to do that. Unfortunately, sometimes they don't always tell us exactly the situation they are because they're protecting a relationship that exists between them. And so all of a sudden now we find that somebody's not getting paid because they've filed against our bond. Then we go back and say, what happened to the conversation we had where you said everything was fine? And we hear stories like, well, my accounting records weren't up to date, you know, those type of things. I'm protecting my relationship, but they get very upfront and honest. So this would make it much more streamlined. Everybody would have to be upfront. It's not an onerous procedure to file your intent on the bond or your rights to lien to file on the bond. So we'd ask you to support this bill 2890.
Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Anderson? All right. Mr. Sitz, did you have anything further?
If I could, do I need to re-identify myself?
No, go ahead.
Okay. I'm not, my testimony is written, and a lot of what I had to say was very similar to what Cindy and Dave have said, but I am going to try to give you a case study that is very near and dear to us and still occurring. We just completed a project for Multnomah County in Gresham. We hired an electrical subcontractor and asked, as we always do, that they provide us the names of the suppliers, and he did, and his subcontractors. And as our monthly payments became due, we made the telephone calls to all the right people to make sure that everything was fine, and every month for a year received the same information. He is current, everything's fine, no problem, so we went ahead and direct paid the sub as we think we should do. He went broke in the last month of the job, and that same supplier, who had been assuring us every month all during the course of the project, has $30,000 worth of bills. And we found a supplier that he didn't tell us about, and that's another $10,000 worth of bills. And right at the moment, we're still talking about it, but it's $40,000 cash that we're going to have to pay twice for this particular project because the subcontractor went broke. Now, you could say, okay, do a better job picking your subcontractors so you don't have guys that go broke. The reality is that we can't identify them very well in the marketplace. If you talk to the suppliers, they actually are very protective of those contractors because typically when they recognize a problem, their bill is very big between them, and they need them to exist if they want to get any of their bills paid. And so they protect them with words. They don't tell you how bad they are or how far in arrears they are. It's not in their best interest to do that, and so they don't. And when they have a public project, they use that as leverage. They can get to this bond very easily. And so if a subcontractor goes broke on a public project, that then makes suppliers for that able to recover money. And there's no doubt in our minds it's money not only for this job but for other jobs, particularly for generic materials like wire and conduit and switches and plugs, stuff that are used on every job. It's very difficult to identify that they're in this job. But as long as the subcontractor who no longer exists has put an initial on a piece of paper somewhere, that supplier is going to get paid. And that sort of occurrence happens, and we end up paying twice and sometimes three times, and sometimes for materials that didn't even belong on this job. And it's because of the public side bond, which isn't on the private sector in the state of Oregon.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Representative Atkinson, thank you.
Thank you for coming today. I just have one question. And as I've listened to testimony, I don't think that this question would apply, but I need to ask anyway. Occasionally, in my experience, some general contractors have gone out of business. Would this at all protect the subcontractors who are in now, as this bill would suggest, in line? As you presented the bill, it's the opposite of my question. Mm-hmm. Is there a safeguard the other way?
Well, the bond exists now, which would protect them. The bond is in place. So as a general contractor, what ends up happening is if they file against the bond, our bonding agent, our bonding surety, comes to us and says, you need to pay this, or we're going to pay it on your behalf, and we'll get it out of you later. And in fact, they're very good at doing that. So if, in fact, we went bankrupt, the subs would be protected by our surety, and the owner essentially could close on the bond or each individual sub. So they have all the protection, essentially.
Right. I realize that's an archaic question. I understand that portion. I had experiences where we would go against failing business and not be able to collect. Not very fun.
No.
Even with or without a bonding agent.
It is not easy to collect on bond. The bonding company will defend their right to not have to finish the work pretty stridently because it costs a lot of money.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sids?
Yes.
Is that correct? Mr. Sids, we passed a bill out of this committee a couple of weeks ago that dealt with prompt pay.
Yes.
And so my question has to do with, doesn't that bill correct your problem? If now everybody's required to pay within 30 days or face penalties, doesn't that correct the problem that you're alluding to that this bill would correct?
I guess the short answer is yes, mm-hmm. But we're in an environment where the business that a subcontractor does when he's going broke is hidden. I mean, he really is struggling to stay alive, and how he acts isn't necessarily very above board. And he doesn't necessarily tell us all about his relationships, and he doesn't want to. He wants to have that cash in his hands, and he doesn't want to pay. His goal is to hold on to as much cash as he can for as long as he can. And so he wouldn't necessarily, one, care what the law said, because he's going to go broke anyway.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
But if the prompt pay bill says that he has to pay within 30 days, and they don't, then you're going to know within 60 days from a lot of people who are pretty ticked off that they're not being paid. And my understanding is this notice requires 120 days, gives them 120 days. So you're talking 6 months as compared to a couple of months before people will be coming out of the woodwork saying, where's my money?
I don't know the absolute specifics of the prompt pay bill, but I know that it's pretty easy for a supplier to put pressure on the general contractor through this bond. It is not hard for them to enforce it, and it's not hard for it to have it be in place, and it's very strong. They get paid when they make a claim against us.
Representative Atkinson, do you have a
question? Yeah, I think there's two shifts doing this. Under the prompt pay, you have payment from agency to prime, prime to sub, sub to sub. We're talking about the situation they're talking about is when a sub or a sub of a sub. They hate to be called subs, by the way. When that contractor, that small business is going out and they receive their funds, payment from wherever the cash stream is, they in turn often can, history has shown, be very careful here, don't pay their bills. The sub doesn't pay the supplier bill, doesn't, for instance, pay for all the lumber that they have on credit or all the equipment they had on credit or whatever. And then when that company goes due, those creditors to the sub have to, then they're the ones that go back on the bond. So in essence, the prompt pay is a cash flow, and the bond is actually accounts payable, APAR situation. So it's actually, it sounds similar, but it's in business practice, the cash flow is actually different. Does that make sense?
Yes, Representative Atkinson, I appreciate that. Thank you.
That
was good.
Yes. Any further questions? All right.
Are there any further answers?
That would be the next question. Are there any other
Ask Bill.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Next up will be Jerry Van Scoy and John Gervais, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Gervais, and on this particular bill, House Bill 2890, I'm representing the National Electrical Contractors Association, the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association, Oregon, Construction Industry Committee, International Union of Elevator Constructors, and the National Association of Credit Managers, all in very strong opposition to House Bill 2890. I'll just make my comments very brief. There are a couple of other individuals here that have probably more on the ground experience than I. But we feel that this is an unnecessary burden on the subcontractors when the general contractor requires this. It's an increased cost, and you can multiply it just by the number of people that are going to be involved in the various contracts throughout the state. We, by the way, there are 43,000 registered contractors under the Construction Contractors Board now. We feel that a general contractor has... they choose to have a responsibility. They resist, for instance, direct bids to electrical or sheet metal and that sort of thing, which would solve some of the problems. We feel that they have a responsibility to administer the job, be on the job, know who's there. There's also the public agency that's involved in it and has some familiarity with the people and the processes. We're concerned about the people that might be left out. One of the groups that I represent, their employees would have to know when and who to file a claim on the project if the employer didn't pay them. And we have one particular situation, although it's not public in nature, with Oregon Steel, where the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers is out $400,000 on health benefits and pension plan, and so there are risks and responsibilities on both sides. We think the system is fairly well balanced, and we think this would be a cost that would exceed the amount of liability that is actually being experienced in the field.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You say this will cost. Could you get in a little bit more detail? What's it going to cost or why?
The numbers, through the chair to Representative Harper, the numbers of individuals that are going to have to provide notices to activate or keep secure their right to bonding protection will up the cost by each contractor or each organization that provides labor or whatever that has to go through that process.
Go ahead.
And then a little form about this big where you sign at the bottom?
Well, usually the service is provided, like the Building Material Dealers Association, something like that, that does that for contractors, subcontractors. We don't mind being called subcontractors, even sub-subs occasionally. We're subservient. We're the little people, I guess, need the protection. But usually people will go through some organization to do that, those suppliers, especially the contractors may do their own, but there's a cost factor in terms of just the staff time and identification and preparing the material and sending it and so on and so forth. And he could speak to the cost of that.
My name is Pat Jones. I'm a credit manager with Consolidated Supply Company, and I've been credit manager with Consolidated for supply for about 15 years. And each notice, to answer Representative Harper's question, generally runs a minimum of $20, and depending on how many times you have to, how many different entities you have to send that to, there could be more than one original contractor, I suppose, on a project that would just get multiplied upwards. It's a certified mail notice, frankly, I'm not sure there's nothing in the bill that indicates where you're to get that information, how you get that information to send the notice as to who the contractor is.
Thank you.
Questions? All right. Go ahead and resume your testimony, if you would, please.
Jerry Vansquick, Associated Floor Covering Contractors. Typically, I would say that the first of all, we sympathize with the Larry Sitz and Emmerich and anyone else who's out there that's lost money. I know the floor covering people, we have the dubious distinction of being the tail enders, and when we get to the job site, especially on housework, it's not unusual for my members to call up the mortgage lender to find out if there's any money left. And usually, as you might suspect, on housework, we're told no, so there isn't any money left. So I guess most of us are more concerned about being paid once, you know, and not twice. So the same thing is true on commercial work. We come in at the tail end, so we're very cognizant of the notices and the liens and so on and so forth. But I would say that most of the concerns by AGC are addressed in this contract document I'm holding in my hand. This was negotiated, quote unquote, by AGC National together with many, many different specialty contractor groups headquartered back in Washington. It's called AGC Document 640. And in response to one of their concerns, I would just read you the one of the provisions that are in here because it kind of hits the. This is titled Delegation or Subcontracting of Duties. The subcontractor, in this case we're talking the first tier, is prohibited from delegating, transferring, conveying, subcontracting, relinquishing, or otherwise disposing of the whole or any part of its duties under this subcontract without the prior written approval of the contractor. So, every job that there is, the general contractor has to have a subcontract with each one of his subcontractors. And this is 20 pages of provisions. And this is, you know, I hate to say it, but this is actually is a pretty fair contract because it was negotiated between the general contractors and a whole bunch of the subs, including NECA and the mechanicals. And all the ones that you might think would be involved in this. But I suspect you know, that it probably is not being used by a whole bunch of the general contractor people. But nevertheless, my point is that we all take risk. My members get beaten up daily, in particular, again, since we come in at the tail end of the job. We get beaten up daily, and yes, we take our lickings, and yes, we do lose money on any given job. And you always hate to hear the horror stories, just like the Emory job. But, I mean, it's a risky business, and I think if you're in it, you're going to anticipate part of it. And I can't see why we would have hundreds and thousands of contractors, subcontractors, and architects, surveyors, and engineers give another notice, a pre-notice, which would be required on line 15. This is a whole new additional notice that we're talking about. We already have to give an information notice on housework if we're the original contractor. On other work, we have to give notice of the right to lien to protect our lien rights. We have to give a notice here to the contractor if we're going to make a claim against the bond. We literally now are buried in notices. And, you know, we're just looking at another cost of doing business. And I don't think, certainly don't think we need it. And it is puzzling to me that AGC is putting forth bills like this, and there's been absolutely no consensus whatsoever developed with any of the other players in the trade. It's just more or less as a unilateral self-interest type of a bill. Thank you.
Next question. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way I read this bill, as a subcontractor, you would have to keep these notices like in your pocket, and every time you went out to buy nails or materials, or if you hired someone else to be a sub under your contract, you'd have to whip one of these out of your pocket and say, well, you have to sign this first before you completed the financial, well, maybe not first, but at the same time that you're completing whatever other business you're taking care of. And if you're a sub, I'm assuming you're working on more than one subcontract at any given time. And so just thinking about it in that thought process means there's a lot of paper that's being collected. And I'm not sure. Now, this goes back to the prime contractor, the way this bill is written.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, that's correct.
And that would improve the system because they would know who you've done business with.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, that's what they're maintaining. I'm maintaining that can already be done in their subcontract document.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair, does the subcontracting document state what the process would be for subcontracting or buying materials and how that process currently works?
That I don't know. I haven't studied it that closely, but it certainly lays out the provisions. And Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, excuse me, that they have all latitude. The general contractor sits in the driver's seat. He designs his own. This is a canned approach. Most general contractors would take the good parts that favor their position, you know, and then they'd strike out a lot of the parts that would be in favor of the subcontractor because they, like I said, they try to beat up on you in certain cases, and that's just the way the game is played. And sometimes we get one contractor, I'm not going to mention names, but he sends out a contract that's about 3 inches thick. You know, and a lot of my members, they just take and they throw it in the trash can. You know, they don't bid his work because they're not going to sign anything like that. It's like signing your death warrant. So many of these things can be done in the contract, but I guess our concern is down here on lines 26 to 30. When you get it, this language, by the way, on 26 to 30, Mr. Chairman, it looks like it was taken out of Chapter 87.021, which is the Notice of the Right to a Lien. When it says 8 days in here, I'm just guessing because I'm not sure. I didn't draft it, and it hasn't been explained. But if someone goes in and completes his work in a couple of days and then sends this notice afterwards, I guess maybe it isn't even covered. I don't know what the what the full meaning is of the language on 26 to 30. It isn't clear to me at all exactly why we have this. It's a pre-notice for a notice for a bond claim, but yet we have 8-day language in here, and I don't know what that means.
Mr. Chair, the courts have ruled that regardless of whatever kind of claim that you're filing, that whether it be lien law or bond, if you're in a situation where it's a very short-term situation, that prudent notification of the owner or whomever has to be within the time frame that you're working. If it's something where you're going to be in and out in 2 days, you don't have the right to go 8 days back to file a notice.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. I want to have Cindy Cato come back up for a moment, representing AGC. We do have Dash 1 amendments here, and I wanted her to talk to us about that for a moment. And I also wanted to ask a question, too, about the contract document that we've heard so much about up to this point. Could you address the amendments first, please?
Okay. Representative Wilson, members of the committee, Cindy Cato, again, from AGC. We've worked with the Bureau of Labor and Industries on Dash 1 amendments, and the reason for those amendments is to specify individual workers are not required to file a notice, that only one notice is required, and it is by the contractor or supplier, the company. Individual workers still, their rights are not changed in any way. And I believe Boley is here to speak on the fact that we collaborated with them. So that, I hope, clears up one of the questions.
All right, thank you. And then about that subcontract document, why is it not sufficient as purported here?
The subcontract document doesn't deal with material suppliers or equipment suppliers. And since those are one of the chief concerns for the double payments, it only deals with the subcontractor to subcontractor relationship, and is silent on the material suppliers relationship.
Thank you. While she's here, anybody have any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Was this a collaborative process, and if so, who were the collaborators?
This was a collaborative process within AGC.
Ah.
And AGC represents general contractors, specialty contractors, equipment suppliers, material suppliers, the whole spectrum of people involved in the construction industry. But it was an internal to agency, and we've proposed this. And also, I might add, we are proposing other bills to the lien law statute. There were references to the other lien law statute. Those aren't going to be heard in this committee. They're being heard in another committee. But we want to put everybody on parity, and so there isn't confusion between public and private work. The types of notices are required now on residential work. They're also required on commercial work for material suppliers. And we just feel that it's important to the industry to have everybody on the same playing field.
Thank you. Appreciate it. While we're on the subject of Bureau of Labor and Industries, Paul Tiffany. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Tiffany, the Government Relations Manager for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm here today representing Jack Roberts, the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. As Ms. Cato indicated, we have worked with AGC to address our concerns about wage claims and individual workers under this bill, and we do support the Dash 1 amendments and hope that you will adopt them. And with those amendments, we don't have any objections to the bill.
All right. Thank you. Questions? All right. Thanks, Paul. Okay, next up will be, let's have Doug Riggs, Phil Donovan, Gary Wright, please.
Good Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Phil Donovan, representing the Oregon Equipment Rental Association. The Oregon Equipment Rental Association opposes House Bill 2890 because pre-claim notices against the payment bond on a public works project are unnecessary. Requiring a rental company to send a notice to a prime contractor who's already under contract, frankly, doesn't make a lot of sense. And just like to state that there are members of our association who are members of the AGC, and to my knowledge, those folks have not been contacted in terms of building consensus on this bill. And with that, I'd just like to close, because much of our concerns about increased costs have already been addressed before the committee. I have circulated, though, a document from Mike Scott, who's an attorney for the Oregon Equipment Rental Association, that better gets at the heart of this issue.
Thank you. Just a quick question for you, and that is that under your interpretation of this, then every time you rented a piece of equipment to a subcontractor, then you would have to provide this.
That's right, and there is some concern about the situation if you were to have, say, a backhoe that would go out to a number of different sites, but under the same construction contract, each time you would have to put out such a notice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Riggs. I work for PacWest Communications, and we represent a number of organizations, including the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, who I'm here testifying today on their behalf. Let me make it very clear. In spite of the earlier testimony that you heard, this was not a collaborative process. Our members of the Oregon State Building Trades and Construction Industries Council was not consulted about this bill. The Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association and their members were not consulted about the bill. I think you heard John Gervais' testimony from NECA earlier. This has not been a collaborative process, and we think that when something is not broken, you shouldn't fix it. So, in a nutshell, bottom line is this bill is paperwork overload 101. The effect of this measure will be to replace Oregon's current bond claim process with a cumbersome, expensive, and wasteful process that will increase both costs to the taxpayers and to small businesses. Let me just make a couple points here. The fundamental problem with this bill is it assumes that there is going to be a problem, or forces a subcontractor and a sub-subcontractor to assume that there will be a problem up front. So putting yourself in their shoes, your subcontractor has just won a fairly significant size subcontract for your company, and you're being asked to file a pre-claim notice with a contractor who just awarded you this contract. That immediately puts you in an adversarial relationship, or a relationship where you're suggesting to the general contractor that he may fail to pay you at some later point. So it sets up a recipe for distrust or mistrust at the beginning of the process that we think is unnecessary. I also want to point out, and I'll skip some of my written testimony, that the committee passed a prompt pay bill, as Representative Bowman testified to just a few minutes ago, and it passed the House, I believe, 57-0. We believe that this bill will help assure some of these problems are addressed. I point out that one of the earlier witnesses agreed that this would go part of the way to addressing their concern. Another problem that I think was addressed with prompt pay is the problem of paperwork. You and public agencies and local government shared concerns about creating policies that would increase operating costs for small businesses, and that's really what this bill would do. It would force a small business with 4 or 5 or 6 employees to file a pre-claim notification on each and every single one of their subcontracts. And then if they have suppliers, that supplier would be required to file the same thing, even if he was only dealing with a subcontractor. So we believe that that obviously is an unnecessary burden. Bottom line, Mr. Chairman, we need less bureaucracy, not more bureaucracy, and we certainly don't need the help that this bill suggests. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Gary Wright representing myself, UA Local 290, the plumbers and the pipe fitters, Oregonians to maintain community standards, and the state building trades. We've also handed out some written testimony from Oregonians to maintain community standards. Neither one of us or any of the three above mentioned organizations were part of the coalition participation, so I guess we're in opposition to 2890. We feel things are working fairly well the way they are. And I guess from some of the previous testimony, I guess we could turn this around just a touch, where it sounded like the general contractors are worried about the subcontractors going broke. Well, from the subcontractor standpoint, we're worried about the generals going broke a lot of times and not getting paid. So we're happy with the way it is right now.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes. All right. Thanks very much. That exhausts my sign-up sheet. Anybody else here to testify on this one? All right. Thanks. I think the only thing I would say here is, you know, I can sympathize with anybody who gets trapped in double payment. That's a bothersome thing, but it's obvious here that we haven't had much conversation going on with all these parties here. If this thing is going to fly any further, I would appreciate all the parties getting together, and if there's consensus, that's fine. We might, as a committee, be willing to work this, but I would think we're a long way from that right now. So I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2890. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2891. And Kara, would you tell us a bit about that bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2891 has to do with design-build contracts and when their obligation on their surety bond is done. There's a -3 amendment, I think, at your place. If you don't have one, let me know. That makes it a little bit more clear than the original bill as to when that time period expires. And I think there's quite a few people to come up and talk about this one. I don't know who.
Okay, I think I'll go ahead and call up, let's see. Well, all right. I only have four people signed up here on this one, which kind of surprises me, but let me call them up. They've signaled an idea that they want to come up together. That would be Larry Eisenberg, Darren Elke, I hope, Scott Williams, and Ken Stoneman, please. Gentlemen, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Larry Eisenberg. I'm the facilities manager for Washington County. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 2891. I appear today representing not only Washington County, but the Association of Oregon Counties and the Public Contracting Coalition. The Public Contracting Coalition is a group that you may be aware of that's come together to look at the vitality of the building construction industry and represents a broad cross-section of public owners like myself, the building construction industry, small and large contractors, architects, construction management consultants. The testimony that I've submitted to your committee, in fact, on the back has a full list of the membership of the Public Contracting Coalition. Over the last 2 years, this coalition has worked on a variety of issues on the construction industry, specifically looking at the CMGC construction manager general contractor issue. The coalition developed a white paper and in turn has worked on training with public owners and members of the industry to improve the way CMGC occurs. This coalition was asked, and my fellow members are here today representing some other parts of the coalition, have worked together to look at the design build question and specifically looking at how we can improve and utilize design build in the construction business today in the state. As the county's facilities manager, an important part of my job is to choose the correct tool for delivering construction projects, whether it's new construction or remodeling. And there are really three different choices that one has today in doing that. One can look at the traditional approach, the design bid build approach, where in fact an architect or engineer is hired, does design, that design is bid out and a contractor is hired when construction occurs. Another choice one has now is the construction manager general contractor approach, where a architect and construction firm is hired at the same time. The three parts, owner, architect, engineer, and contractor, sit down together and work on the design and then subsequently build the project, sometimes under a guaranteed maximum price approach. The third approach that's gaining in popularity has been used very actively in the private sector, but it's coming to the fore now in the public sector, is design build. And looking at design build, it's become clear that there's one issue that needs to be resolved, and it relates to the way that the public interest is protected in terms of the bonding environment and the insurance environment. That's one area that's been unclear. House Bill 2891 is designed to provide that clarification. What happens now when we do a project under design bid build, as a public owner, I require a performance bond from the contractor to assure us that construction is going to happen in an effective way. Similarly, I require from the designer an errors and omissions insurance policy that assures that their work is going to be done correctly to standard. If there's a problem later on, I can go back after either of them separately under the two different types of coverage that I've required of them. Under design build, I only do one contract with the team, which includes a contractor and a designer. The insurance requirement then is not clear when I do that one contract. What we're looking for is a change in the law that clarifies, in fact, that the performance bond applies to the contractor within the design-build relationship, and the errors and omissions coverage applies for the design member within that partnership as well. So it's a subtle kind of distinction, but an important one to provide for ongoing protection of the public in terms of how we do this kind of contracting on the public's behalf. Design-build offers significant advantages to the public sector. It gives us a chance to look at innovative techniques and approaches in terms of how we do construction. There's certainly a speed factor in terms of how we can do projects, and design-build certainly offers us cost savings as well when we're looking at choices, picking the right tool for the right job. Washington County has used design-build now twice. In the early 1990s, our public service building in Hillsborough was built using design-build, a major project, $16 million, designed and developed and provided in a very effective way. We are currently completing a $20 million road and fleet operations facility using design-build. It's only taken us 11 months to go from contract to occupancy on that project. That's a tribute to the design-build process. I'm asking this committee to support House Bill 2891, specifically Amendment 1 to the bill represents the consensus of a contracting coalition. By approving 2891 and the amendment that we've offered for this bill, it's the belief of the coalition that public owners will continue to be protected, contractors will be able to compete more effectively for available public work, and of course that in turn means that with better competition, taxpayers get a better price for the work that needs to be done. I welcome any questions that you might have about House Bill 891 and my testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Starr.
Yeah, Deputy Minister.
Yeah, Stash 3 is the amendment that we're supporting.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, next.
Good afternoon, Chairman Wilson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Darren Olke. I'm here today on my own behalf as a professional with over 8 years of surety experience. During the course of my surety career, I've underwritten numerous design-build projects ranging from general building to heavy engineering. Let me back up for one moment. When discussing surety bonds, it is important to keep in mind that they are different from insurance. In insurance, the underwriters collect a premium, pool those premiums to pay future losses. So basically, if you have a covered loss, the insurance company then pays and everybody's taken care of. In surety, it is different. Surety is a form of indemnification in that the surety is made whole by the contractor in the event of a loss. So if the surety does pay a loss, the surety then goes back against the contractor to recover those losses. Because surety is a form of indemnification, the surety company looks closely at the contractor that is asking that they provide bonds for. The surety underwriter will look at the contractor carefully in the form of its organization, its ability to perform the work, and its financial base. Key is the financial base, because the contractor is expected to repay any losses. The larger and or riskier the project, the closer the surety looks at the contractor's organization, and more importantly, at its financial base. In design build, the contractor assumes the design responsibilities, which is different than in a normal design bid build project. The surety community views these additional responsibilities as an increase to the risk to the contractor. The proposed consensus House Bill 2891 will clarify that the surety bond will include the design of the project up through the completion of the project only. By adopting House Bill 2891, the surety community will view publicly owned design build projects as having less risk to the contractor than a publicly owned design build project if House Bill 2891 is not adopted. As design build projects have more responsibilities and hence more risk to the contractor, surety underwriters require contractors to have significantly larger financial bases before they will consider writing bonds for them. Without House Bill 2891, only contractors with significantly larger financial bases will be able to qualify for bonds, thus limiting the number of contractors competing on design-build projects and result in potentially an increased project cost. With this in mind, the members of the Public Contracting Coalition has asked that we speak to you regarding the proposed bill. It is with the public's interest in mind that we respectfully request that you approve this consensus bill. I welcome any questions you might have.
Thank you, Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who are the members of the Public Contracting Coalition?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowman, on the back of my testimony is it's a two-page document. On the back is a listing of the membership of the Public Contracting Coalition.
Thank you. I see that. If I may follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Funny bone over there.
Go ahead.
Thank you. My next question has to do with design build is a fairly new phenomena. Most public agencies are not involved in design build projects. Most are required to get the lowest responsible bidder is the person who gets the contract. So why would we be changing state law when there's so few people who are involved in design build public contracting and will be in the future? Anybody?
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to take a pass at Representative Bowman's question. Design build, as I mentioned in my testimony, is a newer delivery system for public contracting. You're correct that a fair number of entities have not taken advantage of that. But for certain kinds of projects, design-build really is the correct choice. It is ultimately in the taxpayer's interest. It's faster. It's cheaper. When you're talking about a project that is relatively straightforward to be done, design-build really makes sense and, in fact, offers an advantage over design-bid-build in that it is cost savings and faster. And in some cases, the public needs something quickly and, of course, wants it most cost-effectively. So design build, in my estimation, is going to be a growing kind of delivery system that we're going to see more in the public sector. You're right. At this point, few entities have chosen to do it, but as part of the preparation for a wave that we see coming, this is an important clarification that's going to make this possible.
If I may follow up once again, Mr. Chair. Mr. Williams, I appreciate your comments, but as far as I know, the public's not jumping up and down. The public agencies aren't jumping up and down thinking that this is a new creative thing to do. It's been my experience that construction companies have been pushing this design bill for for a few years, saying, this is the new model, this is the way to do public design. But in my experience over the last 5 years, I've seen no movement on the public side, a few exceptions, to think that this will be the way we will be contracting in the future. I think it's optimism.
So the testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman Wilson and committee members. My name is Ken Stoneman. I am the state construction engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity today to consider House Bill 2891 and to give me the opportunity to testify before you today. I'm here today to express ODOT's support for House Bill 2891. I'd like to give a little introduction from ODOT's perspective. I know that Larry and Darren have given quite a bit of information on the technical side so far. House Bill 2891 was developed to clarify the requirements of the contractor's performance bonds on public works contracts using the design-build method of contracting. Current statute language could unduly encumber contractor's performance bonds for a longer period of time than necessary, and the outcome of this bill would keep responsibilities for insurance and bonding similar to the current design-bid-build contracting process and would not reduce protection to the public contracting agencies. And I think that's an important part from a public owner perspective. During the 97 Oregon legislative session, interest was expressed by some legislators to consider, or for ODOT, to construct a number of projects using the design-build contracting method. This method of contracting on public works highway projects is new to the construction industry, and some states have recently tried on a few of their projects. I might mention there's quite a bit of experience in the building industry with this method, however it is quite new to the highway construction industry. Although the legislation for ODOT to use the design-build method did not pass during the 97 legislative session, ODOT did pursue an aggressive plan to develop a design-build contracting process and to actually contract some projects using this method. We'd anticipated that there may be some cost savings and or time savings on some types of complex projects using this method. An important part of the process was for us to develop a consensus with a lot of our stakeholders out there. And so ODOT brought a number of key stakeholders together to identify and analyze what changes to the current ODOT design bid build method would be needed. And this group included representatives from the Association of General Contractors, the Federal Highway Administration, design consultants, insurance and surety companies, local governments, TriMet and ODOT. And as you can see, we tried to gather all of the people that would be affected by this different type of method, and were able to resolve most of the issues. After working through all of those issues, the issue of performance bond encumbrance remained unresolved with what the current statute language was. ODOT then, since we were a member of the Public Contracting Coalition, decided to use this coalition to help us formulate a solution to the problem. And House Bill 2891 is the consensus outcome of that group, with all in agreement. Currently, ODOT has two design-build projects underway, and learnings to date show that this contracting method is viable on a few types of projects. As I mentioned earlier, these mainly, from our perspective, would be complex projects where innovation from contractors' early participation in the design is likely to result in cost savings to the project, or where time is of the essence and the quicker delivery process for design-build would benefit the project. To sum up, I would like to say that the contractors who participated in the shareholder or the stakeholder meetings and who competed for ODOT's two design-build contracts indicated at the time of their willingness to endure the current statute language while we went through our pilot period. However, they also indicated that they had concern about continuing to participate in future design-build projects if this issue was not adequately addressed. And Scott Williams from Hamilton Construction will discuss this further in just a minute. This potential lack of participation could severely impact the economic benefits gained from a healthy competitive field of bidders. And that's why we think that House Bill 2891, the clarification, is important to us. ODOT and the Public Contracting Coalition, which includes contractors, all agree that this bill addresses those concerns, and we respectfully request your support. I'd be glad to answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chairman Wilson and members of the committee. My name is Scott Williams. I'm a partner in Hamilton Construction, and we're a highway bridge contractor located in Springfield. I'm also vice president of the Associated General Contractors of Oregon. I'm here today representing both Hamilton and the Associated General Contractors. We at Hamilton support this legislation for several reasons, and that basically we're a contractor who does 95% of their work in the public sector, and we are very interested in the current trends of using alternative contracting methods such as design-build that many of the public agencies are currently exploring. Because of that interest, I participated in both the ODOT stakeholder group and the Public Contracting Coalition as one of the AGC's representatives that explored design-build contracting methods and its use. And over a period of almost 2 years, we looked closely at this process and its proposed legislation as part of what came out of those meetings. In addition, ODOT currently has two design-build pilot projects being constructed. Hamilton is involved in both those projects. On the first pilot project, we are the prime contractor rehabilitating the Willamette River Bridge at Harrisburg. On the second project, located on I-5 between Gold Hill and Rogue River, we are a subcontractor doing all the bridge work on that project. And I might would say that when we elected to get involved in these projects, our surety, the first question was, why? Do you want to take on this risk? Because we think this is cloudy on where our responsibility ends. But they were willing to support us based on our financial capabilities and that we're a fairly large contractor. AGC believes that in some cases there is value to the public sector to do design-build over the conventional design-bid-build process, and these values have been discussed by others of the coalition. However, if public owners are to continue using this process, we need to clean up the bond insurance issue. This bill clarifies where the surety bond responsibility ends. With the difficulty in obtaining surety credits, this is an important issue to all contractors. If a contractor's bond is tied up clear through the design liability period, this could severely impact the ability of owners to attract contractors to build their projects. I know that in Hamilton's case, we would have to take a close look at how many of these projects we would be willing to be involved in. In conclusion, the coalition believes this bill accomplishes the following: maintains the current protection afforded the public owners with errors and omission insurance and surety bonds, will make the design build project delivery method more competitive by opening up the ability to participate in the process to more contractors, and will lower the cost to owners by lowering the cost of obtaining the surety bond. We urge you to support this legislation, and I field any questions you might have.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. I kind of feel like we've been flying all around the issue and not really landing on it too squarely, and that is the reason, the actual need for this bill. You know, we've spent a lot of time talking about design build and its purported benefits, but I really do want to cut to the chase in a finer fashion on what this bill actually is designed to do. And could you tell me a bit about surety bonds? It's obvious that surety bonds are confused with insurance by some, but could you give me an idea, at least as it relates to your profession, about surety bonding, and does every contractor get only a certain amount of that available to them?
You want me to? I'll feel that first, and Darren might be able to add, but the way most surety companies look at it, and they look at each contractor individually, financial capabilities and the people they employ and a lot of things, reputation, you usually have a project limit that you can bid to, and you have an aggregate limit, which means all the contracts you have that are currently underway. And you, depending, again, on what your finances are, that limit, aggregate limit, could be, you know, a couple million dollars up to hundreds of millions if you're a big contractor. So this, the way design build currently is, there's a question on whether our bond would be tied up and therefore would restrict how many jobs we could do, even though this job may be completed, say, 6-7 years down the road, our bond is still technically tied up and could affect what we could bid.
So under this legislation, then the contractor would be responsible for errors and omissions insurance.
Depending on how the contract is written, with our case with ODOT, and I can only speak to that case, our design professional that we hired provided the errors and omission insurance as a pass-through to ODOT, and ODOT is protected that way.
Okay. Thank you.
I would just add for clarification, Mr. Chairman, that we are trying to keep the separate relationship as what we currently have, that the designer's errors and omission insurance would remain as it does now if, say, ODOT were to go out and hire a design firm to do work for us. And the construction portion, for which we have the performance bond, would also under this bill remain the way it is now, so that the performance bond would cover the performance of the construction. The designer's errors and omissions insurance would cover any liabilities down the road from that.
Okay. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
I think I finally figured out what you guys are trying to do here. tell me if what I think you're trying to do is what you're trying to do here. If, in fact, one person or one organization gets the contract to do design and construction, you want to make sure that the design portion that we have a surety to cover the long term, whether or not there was any defects in the design, is in place as it currently is, but it stays just for the design piece, and that the bond is able to move to whatever the next project is. Is that really what you're trying to do?
In a nutshell, yes.
Oh, gosh, you guys make this so complicated.
They're engineers.
Something about this government process that just makes things so convoluted.
Yeah. Further questions? All right, gentlemen, thank you. Appreciate that. I think I want to study this issue a little bit further before we do anything with it. And I see no reason why ultimately not to move this, but I would like to think about it just a little more.
Mr. Chair.
Is that agreeable?
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, because I am concerned about having statutory language that addresses the design build program when, in fact, it's not currently something that we can do through statute. I mean, it's like individual agencies can decide to go outside of the process if they choose to, based on their own criteria. But I do have a concern about putting it into statute as if this is a normal way that we do public contracting. So I'd like to get some more info on that as well.
All right, thank you, Representative Bowman. And I'd also like to enter into the record testimony from Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities, regarding House Bill 2891, and you'll get copies of that before we work this. Okay. All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2891. Let's see. I'd like to open up a work session on House Bill 3582, and I'll have Kara explain the need for this.
Your staff sincerely regrets my major error in scripting you last week. You should have a script in front of you that to bring this bill back and send it out the correct way. So, did you guys get this?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we did.
Would everyone check your paperwork, please?
No, I don't have that. I don't have it
either. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3582.
Thank you. Representative Bowman moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3582. Any discussion? Any objections? Well, if no objections, we will adopt that motion.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 3582 was sent to the floor without recommendation.
Representative Bowman has moved we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 3582 was sent to the floor without recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? If no objection, motion carries.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
I move House Bill 3582 to the floor without recommendation and be referred to Committee on Agency Performance and Operations and the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you. Representative Bowman has moved House Bill 3582 to the floor without recommendation and be referred to the Committee on Agency Performance and Operations and Ways and Means. Any discussion?
We ought to get through that process by the next session.
Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson? Deck?
Aye.
Bowman?
Aye.
Deckard? Harper? Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Wilson?
Aye. Motion carries. All right, and just an announcement here. In fact, just a couple of things quickly. I wanted to remind the committee that our committee meetings now appear on the Internet, and if you'll click on the legislature site, you will notice that you can go back and listen to our last two meetings. Which is always kind of fun, available to the public, and that is a new feature, and it makes for interesting listening. Caught a little of that from home last weekend. I got the missing on it. And I also want to mention that HJR 35 has been just removed from today's schedule.
Oh.
I'm sorry. All right, we have no further business. Any discussion?
Pardon? You don't know how bad I feel.
Oh, yes. And I think you have been notified that we do have a Monday night hearing, right?
Yes.
Well, thank you.
Mr. Chair, what about House Bill 2140?
House Bill 2140 has been removed and it permanently.
Permanently.
All right.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.
I am sorry.